Science Fiction University.
Hello, and welcome to Science Fiction University.
We're your fan and writer hosts. I'm Blue Gal.
And I'm Drift Glass. And you can visit Science Fiction University at our website, sciencefictionuniversity.com, where you can also contribute to this podcast. There is a Patreon button at our website, or you can mail us a letter and or contribution to Science Fiction University, P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791. And make those checks out to the Professional Left Podcast and not Science Fiction University, because the bank doesn't know who the hell that is. First, a little bit of housekeeping. If you're looking for politics this early in the week, shame on you. You should be doing something better with your life. But if you are, and you want to hear Blue Gal and Drift Glass talk politics, we were on the Bradcast yesterday for a solid hour, talking politics with Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen, and had a ball doing it. We're honored to go. So go seek them out. They're everywhere. They're on Mastodon. They're on Twitter. They have their own link. They have their own website.
Yep. And it's Brad Friedman, and he's on Twitter, and you can find him. Or you can just Google the Bradcast. I'm sure you can find it from there.
Yeah. And he's been doing this for 20 years. You know, we've been doing this for 19, 20 years. So, you know, old hands talking about politics. If that's what you're looking for today, we have that on offer. But this is an episode containing spoilers about the Netflix series Three Body Problem. And we're going to touch on a whole bunch of other related science fiction stuff. Movies, TV shows, novels, novellas, some stuff from 1941, some stuff from 1999. So, you know, you go in warned that you're definitely going to have some spoilers for Three Body Problems. Not as many spoilers as you might think, but we're going to spoil some stuff, so be advised.
Now, we watched the entire Three Body Problem Apple TV series over Easter weekend.
We did.
But we have not read the novel. We started listening to it on audiobook, but it was just at least the first few minutes were just too bloody for us, at least for me. And I control entirely what the entire household listens to. You know,
we don't get to listen to anything except bits and SpongeBob rerun. So,
So listen, our reviews and comparisons are not based on the novel by Chinese science fiction author Liu Cixin, but on the adaptation of that novel by David Benioff, D.B. Weiss, and Alexander Wu. And if Benioff and Weiss sound familiar, they're the guys who adapted the Game of Thrones series based on the George R.R. Martin novels. This is something they very clearly do well.
Yes, they do.
Adapting existing epic novels for television. We've heard it described, this activity, as being excellent landscapers and interior designers as opposed to being architects. They're very good at taking massive and completely realized fictional worlds and figuring out the story's critical path, then cutting and combining story elements to make it possible to film it in a reasonable number of episodes. Mm-hmm. And this series that we watched was 8 episodes for the first book and a little bit of the second book. There's a trilogy.
Yep. A little my understanding, again, having not read it, a little tiny bit of the second book is in there as well, just to continue on. But it's a whole big, dense novel in 8 episodes. Yeah.
And they're planning on 24. They're planning on 3 8-episode series to cover Liu Cixin's trilogy.
The entire trilogy. And and we kind of talked about this process, you and I, on our previous episodes on a little thing called Dune, that Denis Villeneuve's adaptation of Dune, the novel by Frank Herbert. Now, Herbert created this far future, tens of thousands of years in the future, civilization with its own very complex, interrelated politics and religion and cultures and drugs and you name it. And Villeneuve very skillfully combined and cut and compressed story elements to make it filmable. And it took place over the course of 2 movies, and that's fine. But he made it filmable by making wise choices about what stays, what can stay and what can go. Now, we also saw how this process can go horribly, horribly wrong in the last 2 or 3 seasons of Game of Thrones.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You might remember that. Benioff and Weiss had sort of run out of original source material by the end of the 5th season and suddenly had to start building out the world on their own. And it did not end well.
And they had to do that because HBO had a hit and they wanted more.
Finish this. Yeah. And George R.R. Martin was on the 7,000th page of the next novel and wasn't done yet and was busy blogging about baseball and politics. And no amount of money or yelling is going to make him write as fast as they wanted him to write. So they had access to him, but they didn't have access to actually thought out, field-tested source material. So they had to make it up on their own. And like I said, it didn't end well. Star Wars, believe it or not, Star Wars had the same problem. If you look to take the long view of Star Wars, in that there really was no world building going on at all in the original trilogy, in the science fiction sense. There were alien worlds and there were alien races, but we were presented with like a fairy tale with laser swords. We didn't need to worry about the king and the castle and the moat. We didn't need to worry about the internal politics of the empire or how the force worked or midichlorians or how spaceships and droids and lightsabers were manufactured, where they were manufactured, who made those things. We didn't need to know about that. We were just presented with all of that as established facts, as a sturdy frame in which to set a John Campbell hero's journey. A young knight setting off with a band of companions to rescue a princess from an evil villain. That is the original trilogy, period. And it's simple, fun stuff, and it was really well done. But there's nothing in it about imperial taxes or trade disputes or any of that crap until George Lucas decided he wanted to make some prequels in which he has to now start explaining how things work and how they got that way. And that's when everything went completely off the rails with Star Wars.
Well, and he also had to make a large number of McDonald's toys.
Well, yeah. Got to work
tie
it
in
sure.
to his empire and make a ton of money. Yes.
But world building, competent world building before you start inhabiting the world is incredibly important. And you can see it on the screen.
Right. And this is why Denis Villeneuve's adaptation of The Story of Your Life by Ted Chiang works so well as one of my favorite movies, Arrival. Mm-hmm. And also, this is why Three Body Problem works as television adapted fiction. We really liked this show.
Mm-hmm.
They're based on source material in which the author has already done all the heavy lifting. The book is complete. And Benioff and Weiss and Wu had, if they had any questions about Three Body Problem plot and characters, the book is right there for them to lean on.
Mm-hmm.
This is also why we were so hacked off at what Apple did to Isaac Asimov's Foundation trilogy, because they had a solid, well-thought-out fan favorite based on a single critical premise sitting right there. And they decided to go far away from the premise.
They screwed the entire premise up. They really did.
Why did you do that, Apple?
Why did you do that, Karen? Oh my God.
So that's why adaptations of existing works of fiction that have been well thought out and well established stand a better chance of success than original movies that might work out on their own, but then you try to retrofit some larger fictional universe onto the movie after the fact. But let's talk for a minute about the source of all those novels, all that original fiction, and what's been going on in the larger genre of science fiction. Because as that late great 20th century itinerant philosopher Yogi Berra once said, the future ain't what it used to be.
That's true.
Uh-huh. The future in science fiction used to be Kim Kinison, Kimball Kinison, and the lensman of E. Doc Smith's Galactic Patrol. They're out there patrolling the galaxy and fighting sinister thionite smugglers and other evildoers. Now, that was 1948. I had paperback copies of those novels, and I read them, and I loved them in the 70s because I was a kid and I liked them. This kind of fiction was 1948 through the 50s, when we had atomic power and we had rockets, right? So obviously the next step would be atomic-powered rockets. That would lead to bases on the moon and the colonization of Mars, and then Ad Astra to the stars. You know, we're going to go out there to the galaxy and we're going to take our place among the stars. And along with all that really cool big fiction about the future came the fears of the Cold War, which is what we were involved with, which is why we had rockets in the first place, really. Nuclear destruction and mutants and zombies and hostile aliens. All of science fiction wasn't like that, but a lot of it was. But that future with atomic-powered rockets and mutants, etc., never showed up. Faster than light travel is impossible. There were no atomic rockets, so it turned out that maybe space travel would always be really, really expensive. Maybe we were just stuck on this rock forever, which is kind of a bummer when you've been out with Kimball Kinnison and the Galactic Patrol. Plus, the actual future, the future we really have, was arriving faster and faster, and not in some sort of orderly, consecutive way, but kind of all at once. All at once, we're getting cloning and genetic engineering and nuclear accidents and quantum leaps in computing power and AI and environmental disasters and degradation. And we get smartphones and we have global surveillance systems and we have pandemics and we have wars over dwindling resources. That nice, clear, aspirational future of the golden age of science fiction had become chaotic and wildly unpredictable. And science fiction is writing about the future. So any story that any science fiction writer wanted to set in the near future had a good chance of becoming ridiculous almost overnight.
And here's a perfect example of that. This is from an interview with William Gibson in The Guardian in 2020, describing what happened when he ran headlong into exactly this problem. From The Guardian, quote, "William Gibson, I was losing a sense of how weird the real world was." In 2016, William Gibson was a third of the way through his new novel when Donald Trump was elected president of the United States. "I woke up the day after that and I looked at the manuscript and the world in which the novel was set, a contemporary novel set in San Francisco. And I realized that that world no longer existed, that the character's emotional basis made no sense. And that no one's behavior made any sense. Nothing is making any sense after that day, Driftglass."
Everything's weird and crazy, and it's all making no sense at all. And I got a whole third of a novel written. What am I going
to
do?
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Again, getting back to The Guardian, something of this tremendous enormity had just happened, and I felt really lost, says Gibson, and sort of mournful. I was losing this book. The great chronicler of the future had been overtaken by events. This had happened once before. Gibson had been 100 pages into Pattern Recognition, the first of his novels set in a near-contemporary version of reality, when the Twin Towers fell, forcing him to rewrite that novel's world and the backstories of its characters. His future had to catch up with the present. "I thought, you know, this is never going to happen," and it really threw me for about 6 months. All I could do was read the news feed and feel worse about that. But eventually I realized that I wanted to believe I was living in a stub, that something had split off and that things weren't supposed to be this way. It wasn't supposed to be as dire. And having had that passing thought, I thought, wait a minute, Verity, my character, is in a stub. And suddenly it worked. I had a framework that was coming together.
Now think about all the times you've read on social media, we're in the wrong timeline. This is right. The wrong timeline. He just took that and said, okay,
I'll use we're in the that. Wrong timeline. Let's here's yeah. another timeline. Right. So William Gibson retconned. In other words, what was originally intended to be a standalone work into something that is now more straightforwardly a sequel than anything else in his canon. Agency reprises the setup and many of the characters of his last book, The Peripheral. That novel, which fans of Gibson's strangely little-filmed canon will be pleased to hear, is about to be adapted for Amazon Prime by the team that made Westworld. And, of course, it was adapted.
It was. And we loved it. It was a great show.
And we loved
show.
It, right. Yeah. And that novel is set between a London of the early 22nd century after an unspecified apocalypse called the Jackpot has wiped out 80% of the population and a near-future town in rural America, unquote. Mm-hmm. No wonder science fiction based on time travel and virtual reality began to spike.
Yeah.
If the near future is now completely unpredictable, and I would say, you know, this deep change, these huge disruptions, mm-hmm. whether it's 9/11 or January 6th or the pandemic, all of those things, and just the internet, I mean, just social media.
Yeah. Plus all the scientific breakthroughs layered on top of that, which are
layered on top of social disruption.
Exactly.
If all of that becomes completely unpredictable, why write something that might make you look like a fool a month after it's published or in a more disastrous outcome a month before it's published, because then you don't get paid. But if we're not going anywhere, what if you could put on some goggles that would allow us to pretend we're somewhere else?
Mm-hmm.
If we're stuck here, do we have to be stuck here now? What if we could go back and change history? Would that make things better or worse?
Mm-hmm. And please understand, that kind of fiction is wonderful. There a lot of great stories come out of that kind of science fiction, discovering that greater reality behind everyday reality. That's the theme, believe it or not, of a Robert Heinlein short story from 1941 called They. And it's the plot of The Matrix. Everybody knows The Matrix. That's the plot of The Matrix. You wake up one day and you find out the world isn't what you thought it was. And it's the plot of maybe half of what Philip K. Dick wrote. And everybody
Well, it's the time machine, too. I mean, exactly. On a more simple level, right? Yeah.
Well, that's time travel.
Uh-huh.
That's time travel. This is the altered reality. This is the, you discover something going on here and now, right now, that is different than you were told it was.
I see.
You know, but it's still, you're not leaving. You're not leaving the Earth. The Earth mm-hmm. is simply not what you thought it was. And messing around with time travel and alternate reality and secret fictions in the past and VR, that's all fun. I've written 3 time travel stories myself, so I get it. It's a blast to do. But let me tell you about a little secret, just between you and me, Blue Gal, and the 3 people who are listening to this, about true science fiction nerds like us, the real ones. We also really, really want our big science fiction back. The science fiction about Dyson spheres and galactic civilizations and first contact. And we really, really want what's called hard science fiction. That's right. You heard me right. We want it big and we want it hard. So laugh now. Get it all out of your system. We want it big and we want it hard and we want it right now. I know. This is
no comment.
Science Fiction University After Dark. So back to the PG area where we have most of this podcast. Hard science fiction is based on known or extrapolated science. And a good example of this is a 1980 novel, which I read and enjoyed, called Dragon's Egg by the late Robert Forward. And this is from Wikipedia. In the story, Dragon's Egg is a neutron star with a surface gravity 67 billion times that of Earth. It's inhabited by Chila, intelligent creatures the size of a sesame seed who live, think, and develop a million times faster than humans. Most of the novel, from May to June of 2050, chronicles the Chila civilization beginning with its discovery of agriculture to advanced technology and its first face-to-face contact with humans, who are observing the hyper-rapid evolution of the Chila civilization from orbit around Dragon's Egg. As I recall, they left orbit eventually, and they came to our planet, our sun, and removed 3 or 4 tiny black holes from our sun for us that would threaten to destroy our solar system at some point in the future. They were grateful. They were happy. They were our friends. And then they were gone. Back to the Wikipedia entry. As is typical in the genre, Dragon's Egg attempts to communicate unfamiliar ideas and imaginative scenes while giving adequate attention to known scientific principles involved, unquote. Now, Robert Forward knew this stuff because he was a physicist, and his fiction, in it, he used ideas he developed from his career as an aerospace engineer. He also made important contributions to gravitational wave detection research, which I did not know until I did research on Robert Forward. So it shouldn't be a surprise to anyone that Liu Cixin, the author of Three Body Problem, is a computer engineer. He's a nerd like us. His parents were sent to work in the mines during Mao's Cultural Revolution in the 1960s, and he was born and raised in that world. He also cites George Orwell and Arthur C. Clarke as important literary references, which, when you read the book, makes perfect sense. Arthur C. Clarke was a master of big science fiction, big engineering projects, giant engineering projects, and we Earthlings in it are just figuring out how huge and mysterious and overwhelming the universe really is. Think 2001 A Space Odyssey or The Fountains of Paradise, or Rendezvous with Rama. And Orwell wrote about totalitarianism, which is a major theme in Three Body Problem.
So instead of turning inward to virtual reality and time travel, Cixin went in the opposite direction. What if we took a lot of cutting-edge science and science that might be possible in the future, and theoretical physics, and cosmological conjectures about the prevalence of life in the universe and pushed them all to the limit? In that story, who would the protagonist be? who or what would the antagonists be? And what kind of threat would they pose? And I think this is where the novel gets it exactly right. That he knows exactly who the heroes are and who the villains are in his story. Mm-hmm. In The Three-Body Problem, the major protagonists are all young, attractive, genius friends who went to Oxford together. Some are still doing research, some started companies, but they're all still in touch with each other. Mm-hmm. And I think the show gets this exactly right in terms of their friendships, the stresses they're under, the way they relax. All of that, I think, is very believable. Now, the major antagonists are an alien race called the Santee and their human allies here on Earth. The character Yi Wenji made contact with them when she was a political prisoner under the Maoist government of China, which was working on a secret project to try to contact extraterrestrial life. This is the inciting incident for everything that follows. But it's not the start of the show. Instead, the TV show hooks our interest by beginning with violence and mystery. The violence is a communist rally at a Beijing university in 1966. University professors accused of counter-revolutionary thought and who have clearly been tortured are being dragged out to confess their crimes in front of a mob, shouting, "Sweep away all monsters and demons." And this is Mao's Cultural Revolution.
Yeah, everyone in the crowd has their red book and is waving their little red book.
Shaking their red book. One professor will not confess to doing anything other than teaching established science, and he is beaten to death on the stage by student leaders of the mob. It is very graphic, mm-hmm. very violent, and disturbing.
And his daughter's in the audience.
His daughter's watching the whole thing. And his wife's watching the whole thing from the stage, and she is staying in character and in obedience to the mob in order to save her life while her husband's being beaten to death. It's just tremendously disturbing. Mm-hmm. And then they roll the opening credits.
What are we watching now? The History Channel?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah. And we switch to present day with Detective Da Shi, played by Benedict Wong, who is called in on a case of a particularly gruesome suicide of a professor of cosmology and theoretical physics at MIT. Some kind of clocked countdown, it's digital, and it's also the title of the episode, is written on the wall in blood. And the professor also wrote, "I still see it" in bloody letters. Before or after, we're not quite sure, he gouged out his own eyes and died. And he still sees what? We're not quite sure, but he has written in blood over and over again these digital clock times.
Yeah.
And it turns out he is one of several advanced scientists all over the world who are taking their own lives. So this is a mystery. It's almost Sherlock Holmes. It's like, why is this happening? And so now we're really interested. Why are scientists killing themselves?
And to the list of protagonists, we should probably add the authorities. There are, in addition to Benedict Wong, there's also people who are part of a police force. And we're never quite sure whose side they're on until much later in the novel, but they become vitally important to the rest of the story. So there's a third party involved, and those are the cops. Now, from then on, the series moves back and forth between communist China in the past, in the 60s and 70s, London and other locations in roughly the present time, and a mysterious virtual reality game that is accessible only via a headset that shows up out of nowhere based on tech hundreds of years more advanced than ours. It's distributed to people based on no known pattern. It's extremely well constructed, and no one ever sees anyone delivering it or leaving. There's never any packaging. It just shows up, and there it is. Now, back in the past, UNG is the daughter of the professor who was killed by the mob, eventually finds herself as a political prisoner working on the secret project. And she comes up with an idea of massively amplifying the signal they're sending by firing it into the sun. And without any authorization, she goes ahead and tries it. And 4 years later, because the planet that receives it is 4 light years away, she gets an answer. 8 years later, she gets an answer. It's from the Santee, specifically a Santee pacifist begging her not to answer, because if she does answer, the Santee generally will become aware of the Earth's existence and they'll come and conquer us. Mm-hmm. So very bad things will happen. So please, for God's sakes, don't answer this message. But UNG is sick of humanity and believes that we cannot save ourselves, that we're a doomed species who can't save ourselves. So she invites the aliens to come and conquer us for our own good. At that point, you go, wow, wow. And now we have many questions, right?
Right.
So, like,
right.
What's going on with this super advanced VR rig? And how do the Santee, who are 4 light years away, plan to get here, given that faster than light travel in this series and in the real world is impossible? For that matter, how are they communicating with their allies on Earth in real time, given that faster than light travel is impossible? How are they driving some of the world's most renowned scientists to commit suicide? What does a 250-year-old theoretical problem in astrophysics, the three-body problem, the title of the show and the title of the novel, have to do with any of this? And why do we think the Santee is out to kill us all? What motivates them to do that? Now, the answers are, and this is not a spoiler, this is just a bunch of facts. In no particular order, the answers are cryogenics, suspended animation, nanofibers, atomic bombs, particle accelerators, quantum computing, higher dimensions, Fermi's paradox, and the Little Red Riding Hood. So, we're going to take a breath and talk about our impressions of the series as a whole. Now, my darling wife, Blue Gal, told me that this reminded you a little bit of For All Mankind. So,
well, just from the standpoint that it is a multi-character soap opera. Mm-hmm. And the way that they move the story along in large part has to do with the relationships between these young astrophysicists who fall in and out of love, get drunk, go to parties, dress up,
smoke a lot of pot,
go to work, quit their jobs.
Smoke a lot of pot.
And, you know, the drama of the story is based on these kind of human interaction drama stuff, you know.
Yeah.
It's attractive people falling in love, fighting, arguing, making up, going to lovely little houses on the beach in England.
Oh yeah, one of them gets very rich, by the way.
Yeah, and another one of them is very rich.
Yeah.
So there's money. Everyone seems to be employed, mm-hmm, by some, you know, university or some project, and they're able to quit their jobs, or maybe they'll be deported because they quit their job. And mm-hmm, it's just a lot of drama with attractive, sexually available people.
Right. In a recognizably real near future world.
Right. Right. You understand that it's Oxford. You understand, yeah, that it's, they're sitting on the beach in England. And saying beaches suck, we need to go to a warm climate.
Yeah.
And why don't we do that? You know, and they have the power and the money to do that if they want to. And so it's dispersed among these characters, the drama that they have. And yet at the same time, they all realize that many of their colleagues have committed suicide over something that's happened.
Yes.
And that triggers in all of them a problem to be solved, right? They all have this kind of brain that says, oh, something's going on. Let's approach it with a scientific method.
And one of them experiences exactly what these scientists who were killing themselves experiences,
yeah,
herself, and realizes, holy crap, this is exterior to me. This is not,
right,
something going on in my brain. This is someone,
right,
reaching into my brain and doing something.
And doing something. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's that. And then I did also kind of compare it to Arrival from the standpoint of, here is a scientist who has a great number of skills that are appreciated by the outside world, that where they would turn to that scientist to try to solve a problem that they have. Mm-hmm. But the story of Arrival is very intense because it is just this one woman and a little bit tangentially her partner. And otherwise, it's not a bunch of scientists with all of their relationships and being in love and not telling the other person, or everybody knows he loves her, but she doesn't know, and so forth. it's just two people, their experience. That also, you know who the aliens are in Arrival.
Right.
You see right. them. You're experiencing talking to them. Mm-hmm. Whereas in this, you do not really know what you're dealing with. And I kept making the joke to you, Driftglass, as we're watching this, that this is going to be like a Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, where there's an error in scale. And these horrible aliens that are going to show up in 400 years and destroy the Earth just get eaten by a dog, which happens in Hitchhiker's Guide.
Yeah. Oh, but you also mentioned the important fact that because there's no faster than light drive, any threat from these aliens, yeah. is 400 years in the future.
Yeah. And everyone is dealing with that in some way. Do you either just say, oh, screw it? It's long after my great-grandchildren are dead. I have nothing to do with this. I'm just going to live my life. Or do you say, I've only got my lifetime to deal with this.
Right.
So I'm going to do everything in my power to prepare the world because I've been chosen to, with my skills and my abilities, to help the Earth in whatever way I can to approach this disaster.
Well, and there's this sensibility running through and through critics. I've listened to people talk about the show who I like and admire, mm-hmm. who are like, you know, human beings just aren't built to do centuries long projects.
Oh, we can't deal with remembering the pandemic. Most of us have moved on from that because it's too traumatic, right?
I want to tell those people, have you met the cathedrals of Europe?
Yeah.
Have you met the pyramids? Human beings have done centuries long projects before. That they knew would not be completed until long after their children's children were dead because they believed they were serving a higher purpose. It is possible for people to do that. But that's not the world these people live in. They have to convince people at using force and threats, and the planet is under siege, and there's a moment when it becomes clear to the entire planet that something is very, very wrong and needs to be fixed, and they're in danger. That galvanizes people. But that's the big picture. You also said, I think we agree, the casting was really good across the board, but casting Benedict Wong as the detective Dashi was brilliant. That was A1.
Yeah, that is he being the world weary, but also very smart detective who, you know, isn't impressed by either science or drama.
Right.
He just wants to get to the facts and figure out what's happening so he can report to his bosses that he's figured it out.
Mm-hmm.
The one piece of, and I don't want to say it's a bad casting because she's a good actress.
Yeah.
And she's certainly capable of carrying off the emotions of this character. But Isaac Gonzalez as Augie Salazar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She is a nanotechnician. And
she's a nanotech inventor, a nano inventor. She's not a tech. She's
An amazing, brilliant scientist. And this is her project to invent nanofibers that can cut through diamonds with tremendous accuracy. It is her project. She has a lot of people working under her, but she is absolutely in charge of this. And it is her brain that has made this possible, this whole nanofiber project possible. Everyone is applauding her and so forth. And as I said to you, when she showed up on the screen, I said, oh, Keira Knightley was unavailable to make this show.
Yeah.
Because she is absolutely lovely.
She's gorgeous.
She's gorgeous. Her eyeshadow is perfect. It is blended. She has beautiful mascara on. Her hair is lovely and soft. And she absolutely does not look like someone who spends all of her day in a lab.
No.
And so the needs of a show to have a beautiful, attractive woman walking around with the shirt falling off her shoulder and she's drinking wine and she's running around a beach house with her friend is, you know, not reality. And it is jarring, I think, to see someone that you are expected to approach as one of the most brilliant scientists in all of the world.
Yeah. She's a bit of the manic pixie dream physicist.
Exactly. You know? The manic pixie dream physicist is exactly what she is.
And I also want to call attention to Liam Cunningham, mm-hmm. who's the Irish actor you probably know. This is the Benioff and Weiss did Game of Thrones, and he was in Game of Thrones, and you'd know him, you saw him. But he's the authority figure. He's that we're going to do this shit right now. And he's very, very blunt and very, very linear. And my job is to save the planet. I will not let anything get in my way, including if I have to kill lots of people to do it, I'll do it.
Yeah, tough shit. Lives? Who cares,
and
right?
It's his accent and his attitude. And he reminded me a little bit of the lead detective from The Gold.
Oh, yeah,
you know, who was very matter of fact.
Yeah,
who once you got to know him, you understood why people were loyal to him. But he's so good in this and so direct. But these guys who were not physicists, who were trying to solve a crime, who were trying to figure out a problem, and who were trying to get people who don't want to cooperate to do something that they don't want to do to save the world, is fascinating to watch. And again, Benedict Wong as this guy who's got a Gen Z kid.
Yep. Who's not only gay, but also just wants to be a TikToker.
Yeah. I'm an entrepreneur, Dad.
I'll make $1 million, Dad. Don't worry about it. I'm going to be an influencer. And Dad just looks at him like, you're a waste of skin.
Yeah. You know, I love you, son, but that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. And he's a single dad. And it's so three-dimensional and so easy to follow him through this mystery. And he's the guy who has, I believe, the last line in the movie, in the series.
Yes, he does. Let's get to work.
And so it was fun. It was so much fun watching the series. And we did a whole bunch of end guessing as it went along. I did a lot of end guessing. Like, oh, I know what they're going to do here. I know what we're going to do there. And some I got right and some I got wrong. But it was fun. It was fun to watch a competent science fiction series that took its ideas seriously. It was about big science. And so,
and it got to the point very early on as we were watching that Driftglass grabbed a notebook. And that's when I knew we were going to podcast this.
Yeah.
Oh, because every 5 minutes of the show, he would say, oh, that's just like John Varley, or that's just like Isaac Asimov, or that he owes, you know, someone $5. So let's go through some of those, Driftglass, some of the precursors to this show.
I hope I didn't ruin it by just talking.
It was fun to watch you just, oh, Easter egg this. This is fan service for fans of Contact, or this is Arthur Clarke, or this is, no, you just were having a ball, and I enjoyed it.
I was, what's her name from Jurassic Park? This is Unix. I know this. I understand this. You know, this is my world. This is my,
and it's obvious the author and also the showrunners are fans of this kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah. And it's not like this guy, the author, ripped anybody off. It's like, I can see the precursors to them literally. So, for example, you and I watched the TV series The Expanse.
Right.
Right? And it's very similar to that in a lot of respects. It's big. It's set, the Expanse is set further in the future, but it's a recognizable, plausible Earth. There's no faster than light drive. There has been a planetary global weather events, and now New York has a seawall around it because sea levels have risen. The moon has been colonized. Mars has been colonized. The asteroid belt has been colonized and being mined. They've discovered a way of making spacecraft travel very fast, but not faster than light. It doesn't break any laws of physics. And they have accompanying medical technology that lets you survive big, fast, high G acceleration, but there's a price to pay for your body every time you do that. Mm-hmm. And it's complex politics and complex interrelationships and trades and war and so forth. And into this mix, you introduce an alien technology, an alien presence that scrambles everyone's circuits and makes everybody chase off in all directions. So in that sense, for size, scope, and respect for science, this is very much similar to The Expanse in that regard, only in that regard. And The Martian, which, you know, I believe that's Barack Obama's favorite movie so far in the 21st century. I think that's what he said. In The Martian, which I did read the novel and I did watch the movie like seven times, it's only one character and he's being confronted by seemingly impossible obstacles over and over again. And every time that happens, he digs in and, in his words, tries to science the shit out of it. You know, how do I solve this problem? I'm a scientist. I'm an astronaut. I will solve this problem using science and math and figure this shit out. And then on to the next problem and the next problem and the next problem. And if you, as he says at the very end, if you solve all these problems, you get to come home. So it was very much that kind of, you know, smart people trying to figure stuff out. The next one that reminded me a lot of was Nightfall. Isaac Asimov's first or second short story, which always drove him crazy because he wrote 1 million novels and stories after that. And people would say, remember when you wrote Nightfall? I really like that story. Like, yeah, I wrote that when I was 12, you know. But Nightfall is a terrific short story. If you haven't read it, it's about a civilization that's doomed to being wiped out over and over again because of the way its solar system is constructed. And that is really similar in spirit to Three-Body Problem. Three-Body Problem is about a planet that has a crisis, a catastrophic crisis at unpredictable times because of the way its solar system is built. And that's the problem that they can't solve. And a Nightfall is a tragic story because they can never solve this problem because they can never survive long enough because of what happens to fix the problem the next time around. Now, you and I watched Contact mostly for the sexual chemistry between Jodie Foster.
The completely non-existent sexual chemistry between Jodie Foster and Matthew McConaughey.
Clearly, you know, she's crazy for that man. But it was about big science. And again, that's based on original material by Carl Sagan. It's big science and a whole bunch of, you know, people getting together to invest in a big project to achieve a great result because the world may depend on it. Contact with aliens and they send us a message back and we figure it out. But the part I want to focus on just for a second is the idea of a fanatical cult, fanatical anti-science cult.
Yep.
That rises up to sabotage the thing that everyone else is trying to accomplish. And the fact that they're true believers. Yeah. This is not the mob of Nightfall that run at the last minute, takes torches to burn down the libraries and burn down the observatory because they're panicked. This is a methodical, careful, fanatical cult of true believers that you cannot reason with, who have heard the word of God. And know that they're supposed to do this thing and there's no stopping them. And when scientists or people of reason confront a fanatic, a religious anti-science fanatic, there's no point at which their worldviews overlap. And there's no persuading them one way or the other. I also wanted to mention briefly two novels that have nothing to do with each other except one thing, which is The Mote in God's Eye, which is a Niven and Pournelle, or maybe just Larry Niven novel. It's about far in the future, when we discover a species, we call them Motis because they live in a tiny part of a larger nebula. They're trapped inside the nebula. They're unaware of the larger universe. And a novel by Frank Herbert called the Dosidae or Dosadi Experiment. And they're both about populations of planets that exist under enormous pressure. The Mote in God's Eye is caused by the Motis' reproductive cycle. They can't stop reproducing themselves. And eventually their civilization collapses. And this is how their whole religion is built. The cycles. They always die off. They always collapse. The civilization always comes to an end. And they have to rebuild after 90% of them die off. And it all happens all over again. They have no control over it. And they're a terrible danger to the rest of the galaxy. Because if they ever got out, if they ever achieved faster than light travel, they would beat us all at the technology game. Because their millennia of this have made them very, very good at technology because they have to husband the resources of their planet very carefully. So they've got us beat on the technology front. If they ever got out, they would overwhelm everyone else and cause galactic collapse. And the Dosidae experiment is about a population being kept under pressure and privation and starvation and poison on purpose to see what happens. And so most of the people die off generation after generation, but the few that survive, very much like Dune, the few that survive are stronger and smarter and hardier and more capable of survival than the previous generation. And this goes on for a long time until the experiment has created a kind of human being that if they ever got out, they'd be unstoppable. So they can't be allowed to get out. Now they don't want to do with them because they're terrified of the thing they've created. So you have a species that has endured great catastrophe over and over again, and by virtue of that, have become better than us, a lot better than us. And if they ever come in contact with us, we're screwed. I also want to mention John Bruner's Stand on Zanzibar, which is a big, sprawling 1970s novel. Terrific novel. I recommend it to anyone who has never read it before. A small part of that is an anarchist group that blows things up. They're an anarchist just to do it, just to experiment in what it's like disrupting society. And one of the methods they've used in the novel is using a carbon monofilament strung across the mouth of a harbor to wreck a ship and injure lots of people. As I recall, there's a very vivid description of that in the novel, because as the carbon monofilament cuts through the metal, it automatically reseals itself afterwards because it's a one molecule thick cut. Mm-hmm. If it cuts you at the neck and you're standing still, you're just paralyzed because all the flesh refuses back to where it was. But if you're turned slightly, your whole body falls apart because you've been now sliced up like an egg in an egg slicer. I'm not saying that's what's going to happen in this show. I'm just saying keep an eye out for the various uses of nanofiber technology in the show.
For good or ill.
For good or ill. There's also Arthur Clarke's The Fountains of Paradise, which is about the space elevator, a quicker, cheaper, easier way to get us into orbit. And in The Fountains of Paradise, carbon monofilament is the building block of the substance they're going to use to build the space elevator, because it has to be incredibly durable, incredibly resistant to pressure, because it's got to be a cable, essentially, stretching from the top of a mountain on Earth to several hundred miles above the Earth in orbit. And they build part of the tower down from above using an asteroid and part of it up from the bottom. But it has to be incredibly strong. And the only thing that could do the job is carbon monofilament. So carbon monofilament was like the magic substance of the 1970s. It has 1,001 uses. Now, remember the Day of the Dolphin, honey?
Yeah.
We did a podcast.
Yeah, we did a show about that one.
We dipped way into our mailbag to do that. The Day of the Dolphin and Galaxy Quest. Weird combination, I know. But they both involve species who have no concept of lying or metaphors as a plot device. And so when you tell Fa and B, imagine there's a shark in the water. They go, shark in the water, and they run away because they don't understand you're talking about theoretical concepts. They just assume you're lying. Galaxy Quest is the same way. It's a funny movie. It's a pretty good movie. I don't understand why it beat The Matrix out for the Hugo Award that year, because The Matrix is a much better actual movie. But there's a lot of aging Star Trek fans, and they voted for Galaxy Quest, so that's fine. But Galaxy Quest is about a species that took a cheesy 1960s TV show about science fiction, it's clearly Star Trek, seriously, and built an entire civilization and space travel thingy around the concept. This is all real. It's all because they don't understand the concept of lying or metaphor or story. There's an episode in this series, the Three Body Problem series, called The Stars Are Destination.
And you laughed really hard when you saw that.
100% fan fiction, fan service rather. And this fan, for one, deeply appreciates it.
Yeah. 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 So a couple other comments about the Three Body Problem, the TV show. You know a character is in trouble when his one-night stand is killed by an autonomous vehicle.
Yeah. And we find out that it was your one-night stand wasn't just killed, but all the other vehicles involved in moving traffic around so that vehicle could get to you were also autonomous.
Yeah. And that it was a random skateboarder who saved your life.
Oh.
British beaches apparently suck because they're cold and windy and... you should move to a warmer climate.
And they're gravelly. They're covered in rocks. They're cold and rocky, and God, who wants that?
But the scientists who want to sit on the beach, they lack imagination. So they don't see why they shouldn't just drive over to what is called the beach, right?
Mm-hmm.
There are little literary references, because everyone in this show is quite literate. Someone complains that C.S. Lewis is a shitty writer, which is very funny. They mention a story by Pushkin. But then there's this other thing that happens. And I was very impressed. This is how Driftglass impressed his wife.
Yes. It's better than flowers, I think. there's a guy, a minor character, who's supposed to be following Yi Wenji all over the country. His job is to follow her everywhere to see what she's doing. And he's standing in line at an airport because she's going to get on a plane and she knows he's there. and he's reading a paperback, and the paperback is a paperback copy of Dahlgren by Sam Delaney, which I have never read in my life, but recognized by the cover art. And I pointed and said, that's Dahlgren. That's Sam Delaney's Dahlgren. It's more science fiction stuff in the science fiction. And I caught the Easter egg, and I was so happy I did that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I just looked at you like, you are such a nerd.
I am such a total nerd. I also don't want this occasion to go past without mentioning The Brain That Wouldn't Die, which is a cheesy science fiction movie about a head that gets cut off and kept alive in a solution in some goo. And it keeps talking and keeps functioning because of the goo. And there are consequences to that. And all I'm saying is, in the future, that might be possible for some reason that I would never dare divulge to you because that would be wrong.
And also, hey, let's talk a little theology for a moment.
Yeah, a little Bible
there
bitch.
Are some very recognizable biblical parallels. Mike Evans, played by Jonathan Pryce, who is a fan favorite from everywhere, is the wealthy heir to the world's largest energy company. He is also an environmental activist and UNG's partner in all of this. Eventually, he becomes the only person allowed to speak to the Santee's representative on this radio device. He does it from inside a locked room on the tanker he has converted to the cult's mobile headquarters. And he always refers to the Santee representative as my lord.
Mm-hmm.
So the Jonathan Pryce character is the priest of the Inner Temple. And his ship is called Judgment Day.
Yeah.
Except humanity has screwed it up. And now when the Lord arrives, humanity will be wiped out. And only a few will be saved. It's like the flood, Sodom and Gomorrah. It's UNG is clearly playing the part of Moses. She has led her people to the promised land, but she herself will not be allowed to enter.
And speaking of Judgment Day and putting your cult on a boat to move it around as you need, this is from Business Insider, an article on L. Ron Hubbard from December 2016, which is also kind of on point. Quote, Scientology founder L. Ron Hubbard was under investigation in multiple countries and lived on a ship to evade any one country's jurisdiction. In the early years of Scientology, the church was under investigation for being a cult. In fact, in Australia, the religion was banned in 1965 after an investigation. L. Ron Hubbard lived on a ship called the Apollo. It was described as the floating headquarters for Scientology. Since he was being investigated by the UK and other countries, Hubbard found that he could sail away when necessary into international waters and away from the jurisdiction of any one country. Unquote.
At one point, the secret international Santee cult conference is broken up by armed police, which very closely tracks with the story of Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane. The cult is told they must prepare the way for the world to come, so it's an apocalyptic cult. They know that these aliens are coming to destroy the earth.
Well, the end times are coming.
The end times are coming.
Whatever happens, they're going to be saved. They will be saved.
It's just, it's very religious.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And then there is a betrayal by someone trusted by the leader. He's a Judas.
Uh-huh.
A Judas in their midst. So the cops arrive in armor like a Roman legion, and the leader tells everyone, don't resist, just sit down and let them do what they're going to do. And fighting breaks out, and shooting happens. And it would seem like this is a disaster for the cult, but the members we follow afterwards are very calm. All this must be according to the Lord's plan, or else it never would have happened. It's all the Lord. And you just realize she really looks like a weirdo. You know, everyone's been killed. You don't have a movement anymore, mm-hmm. and you're in jail. Yes, it must be the Lord's will. Everything is going according to plan. Uh-huh.
And so if you ever get confused why it's really hard to talk to your crazy Uncle Liberty about politics and QAnon and Trump, everything's part of the plan. And no matter how badly things go, well, that must have been part of the plan too, or else it wouldn't have happened.
Yeah, right, right. Okay. Everything's a fulfilling prophecy. Sure. Mm-hmm. This series, as we've said before, covers the first novel and part of the second in the trilogy of books. Mm-hmm. Again, there's going to be 8 episodes for the 3 books, and so 24 episodes in all. Apple TV has not renewed the series yet, but that's very Denis Villeneuve. I don't have a contract for the second Dune movie yet, but I don't care.
What shall I do? I don't know. Okay, here's money. Go make the movie.
Exactly. Go do. The Game of Thrones guys aren't worried that Apple TV isn't going to renew this.
Yeah.
They could sell it to HBO. They could sell it someplace else. They don't care. And I don't think they're looking to make money. This is not so that they can send their kids to college.
No.
But we are really looking forward to the next two because the books are out. And I think that gives us confidence that these Game of Thrones showrunners, will choose the right way to film these and make them compelling television. Yeah. And we are living in a golden age of science fiction television.
Well, I do want to mention in the book, in the movie, and probably in the book, a book on Fermi's paradox is mentioned a couple of times. And Fermi's paradox is basically, where is everybody?
Yeah.
The universe is big and it's very, very old. And the building blocks and potentiality for life is everywhere. So how are we the only ones out here? And there are a number of possible answers to that question, one of which is being explored, as I understand it, in the second novel. And so the second novel jumps around a lot. As I understand it, it has a lot more, a bunch of scientists in it. There's a character who is designated the Wall Facer in this TV series and more about him in the next novel. So I really look forward to this because it really is taking an enormous sweep of time. And it's truly an epic. It is truly an epic undertaking. And who knows, I might just actually read that second novel. I don't know.
Yeah.
I might do that. What I do know for sure is that Science Fiction University is a project of DGBG Productions, which is here and now and real and not science fiction at all. You can support this show we are doing by donating via Patreon at patreon.com/proleftpod.
And we'll see you next time.
We'll see you next time.